There was enough moon to light their way as far as Vuzamanzi's village. They bypassed the hilltop, not wanting to alarm the old man. A village dog yapped at them, but they found the footpath and hurried along it. Morning found them still on the footpath. Twice they were forced to take cover. The first time was when they almost ran head-on into a patrol of camouflage-clad Shona troopers. Tungata, who was on point, warned Craig with the hand signal for dire danger. They lay in a thick yellow stand of elephant grass beside the path and watched them go padding silently past. Afterwards, Craig found that his heart was racing and his hands shaking. "I'm getting too old for this," he whispered.
"Me too," Tungata agreed.
The second time, they were warned by the whacking beat of helicopter rotors, and they dived into the ravine beside the path. The ungainly machine dragonflied down the far crest of the valley, with a machine gunner in the fuselage port and the helmeted heads of an assault squad popping up behind him like poisonous green toadstools. The helicopter passed swiftly and did not return. They overran the spot where they had originally intersected the footpath and had to backtrack for almost a mile, so it was late afternoon when they approached the wrecked site. They closed in with elaborate caution, circling the area and casting for ingoing spoor, checking with infinite patience that the wreck had not been discovered and staked out. Finally, when they walked up, they discovered that it was undisturbed, and exactly as they had left it. Tungata climbed back up the side of the valley and stood guard with the AK-47, while Craig began stripping the equipment that he had come for. The four inflatable life jackets were under the seats, as Sally Ann had told him. They were of excellent quality, impregnated nylon, each with a carbon dioxide cartridge for inflation and a non-return valve on the mouthpiece for topping up. Attached to the bosom cushions were a whistle and, blessings upon the manufacturer, a light globe powered by a long-life battery. Under the pilot seat was, 1,000 more blessings, a repair kit for the jackets with scissors and scraper and 2 tubes of epoxy cement. The steel oxygen bottles were bolted into a rack behind the rear bulkhead of the passenger compartment. There were 3 of them, each of 2-litre capacity. From them, flexible plastic tubing carried along behind the panelling to each seat and terminated in a face mask with 2 built-in valves. The user inhaled pure oxygen and exhaled a mixture of unused oxygen, water vapour and carbon dioxide. This was passed through the exit valve and ran through the 2 metal canisters under the floorboards. The first canister contained silica gel, which removed the water vapour. The second canister was packed with soda lime, which removed the carbon dioxide, and the purified oxygen was cycled back to the face masks. When the pressure of pure oxygen in the system fell to that of ambient atmosphere, it was automatically supplemented from the 3 steel bottles. The flexible tubing was fitted with top-quality aluminium couplings, T-pieces and bends, all of the bayonet fitting type. Working as carefully as time would permit, Craig stripped out the system and then converted the heavy-duty canvas seat covers into carry bags. He packed the salvaged equipment into them, making up 2 heavy bundles. It was dark by the time that he whistled Tungata down from the hillside. Each of them shouldered a bundle and they started back. When they intersected the footpath, they spent nearly 30 minutes sweeping their tracks and hiding any sign of their detour from the path.
"You think it will hold good in daylight?" Craig asked doubtfully. "We don't want to signpost the wreck."
"It is the best we can do."
They stepped it out on the path, pushing hard, and despite their heavy, uncomfortable packs, they shaved 1 hour off their return time and reached the cavern just after dawn. Sally Ann said nothing when Craig stepped into the cavern. She merely stood up from the fire, came to him and pressed her face against his chest. Sarah bobbed the traditional curtsy to Tungata and brought him the beer pot, letting him refresh himself before bothering him with greetings. Only after he had drunk did she kneel beside him, clap her hand softly and whisper in Cinderbelly, "I see you, my lord, but dimly, for my eyes are filled with tears of joy."
The Shona sergeant had been on foot patrol for 33 hours without rest. The previous morning they had made a brief and indecisive contact with a small band of the escapees they were hunting, an exchange of fire that had lasted less than 3 minutes,
Then the Matabele guerrillas had pulled out and splintered into four groups. The sergeant had gone after one group with five men, followed them until dark, and then lost them on the rocky rim of the Zambezi Valley. He was bringing in his patrol now for resupply and new orders. Despite the long patrol and the trauma of a good contact and hot pursuit, the sergeant was still vigilant and alert. There was an elastic spring in his stride. His head turned restlessly from side to side as he moved down the footpath, and the whites of his eyes under the brim of his jungle hat showed clear and sharp. Suddenly he gave the urgent hand signal for deployment, and as he changed the AK-47 from one hip to the other to cover his left flank and dropped into cover, he heard his men spread and go down behind him, covering him and backing him. They lay in the elephant grass beside the track, searching and waiting, while the sergeant examined the small sign that had alerted him. It was a bunch of long grass on the opposite side of the path. The stems had been broken and then lifted carefully to try to disguise the break, but they had sagged slightly again. It was the type of sign a man might make when leaving the path to set up an ambush beside it. The sergeant lay for 2 minutes, and when there was no hostile fire, he doubled forward 10 paces and then went flat again, rolling twice to throw off an enemy's aim. And he waited 2 minutes longer. Still no fire, and he came up cautiously and went forward to the damaged clump of grass. It was man-sign. A small band of men had left the path here or joined it, and they had swept their spoor. A man only took this much trouble if he was anticipating pursuit. The sergeant whistled up his tracker and put him onto the spoor. The tracker worked out from the path, casting ahead, and within minutes he reported. Two men, wearing boots. One of them walks with a slight favour to his left leg. They were headed down the valley. He touched one of the footprints in a sandy patch. An antlion had built its tiny, cone-shaped trap in the toe of the spoor, giving the tracker an accurate timing. 6 to 8 hours, said the tracker. During the night, they went on the path, but we cannot follow them. Their spoor has been covered by others. If we cannot find where they are going, then we will see where they came from, said the sergeant. Backtrack them. 3 hours later, the sergeant walked up to the wreck of the Cessna. Craig slept for a few hours and then, by the light of the paraffin lantern, began modifying the oxygen equipment for use underwater. The central part of his primitive oxygen rebreathing set was the bag. For this he used one of the inflatable life jackets. Oxygen from the steel bottle was introduced into the bag through the one-way valve of the mouthpiece, the connection made with a length of flexible tubing. As he worked, Craig explained. At a depth of 40 feet underwater, the pressure will be greater than 2 atmospheres. You remember your high school physics? 33 feet of water equals 1 atmosphere, plus the pressure of the air above it. 2 atmospheres, right? His interested audience of 3 made affirmative sounds. Right, so for me to be able to breathe freely, the oxygen has to be fed into my lungs at the same pressure as the surrounding water. The oxygen in the bag is under the same ambient pressure as I am. Et voilà.
My old daddy always used to say it's brains what counts, Sally Ann applauded him.
The chemicals in these 2 canisters remove the water vapour and carbon dioxide from the air that I exhale, and the purified oxygen goes back into the bag via this tube, and I breathe it again. He was sealing the new connections to the bag with epoxy cement from the repair kit. As I use up the oxygen in the bag, I keep topping it up with fresh oxygen from the steel bottle strapped on my back, like this. He cracked the tap of the black-and-white coated bottle, and there was an adder hiss of escaping gas. There are a few problems, of course. Craig began working on altering the shape of the face mask to give him a watertight fit.
Such as?
Sally Ann asked. Buoyancy, Craig answered. As I use up the oxygen in the bag, I'll become less buoyant, and the steel bottle will pull me down like a stone. When I top up the bag, I'll tend to shoot up like a balloon.
Well, how will you beat that?
I will weight myself with rocks to get down to the tomb entrance, and once I'm there, I'll rope myself down to stay there. Craig was making up a backpack on which were suspended the two canisters and the oxygen bottle. Carefully, he positioned the steel bottle so that he could reach the tap over his shoulder.
"However, buoyancy isn't the big problem," he said.
"You've got more?" Sally Ann demanded.
"As many as you ask for," Craig grinned. "But did you know that pure oxygen breathed for an extended period at more than two atmospheres absolute, that is at any depth below 33 feet, becomes a deadly gas, as lethal as the carbon monoxide in the exhaust fumes of an automobile?"
"Well, what can you do about that?"
"Not much," Craig admitted, "except limit the duration of each dive, and monitor my own reactions very carefully while I'm working at the wall of the tomb."
"Can't you work out how much safe time you will have before it starts to poison?" Craig interrupted.
"No, the formula would be too complicated, and there are too many variables to calculate, from my body mass to the exact water depth. Then there's a cumulative effect of the poisoning. Each successive dive will become more risky."
"Oh, my God, darling." Sally Ann stared at him.
"We'll keep the dives short, and we'll work out a series of signals," Craig reassured her. "You'll give me a rope signal from the surface every minute, and if I don't reply, or if my reply is not immediate and decisive, you will haul me out. The poisoning is insidious, but gradual. It will affect my reactions to the signal before I go out completely. It gives us very little leeway."
He set the bulky equipment carefully aside, close to the fire, so that the warmth would hasten the setting of the epoxy cement.
"As soon as the joints are sealed, we can test it, and then go for the bank."
"How long?"
"It's 24-hour epoxy."
"So long?"
"Rest will increase my resistance to the effects of oxygen poisoning."
The forest was too dense to allow the helicopter to alight. It hovered above the treetops, and the flight engineer on the winch lowered General Peter Fungerbearer into a hole in the mat of dark green vegetation below them. Peter turned slowly on the thin steel cable, and the downdraft from the rotors fluttered his camouflage battle smock about his torso. 6 feet above the earth, he slipped out of the padded sling and dropped clear, landing neatly as a cat. He returned the salute of the Shauna sergeant, who was waiting for him, cleared the drop area quickly, and looked up as the next man was lowered from the hovering helicopter. Colonel Bukharin was also dressed in camouflage and jump helmet. His scarred face seemed impervious to the tropical sun. It was bloodless and almost as pale as those cold Arctic eyes. He shrugged off the helping hands of the Shauna sergeant and strode on up the valley. Peter Fungerbearer fell in beside him, and neither man spoke until they reached the crumpled and shattered fuselage of the Cessna.
"There is no doubt?" Bukharin asked. "The registration, ZSKYA. You must remember I have flown in this aircraft," Peter Fungerbearer replied, as he went down on one knee to examine the belly of the fuselage. "If further proof is needed," he touched the neat puncture in the metal skin, "machine gun fire from directly below."
"No corpses?"
"No." Peter Fungerbearer straightened up and leaned into the cockpit. "No blood, no indication that any of the occupants was injured, and the wreck has been stripped."
"It could easily have been looted by the local tribesmen."
"Perhaps," Peter agreed.
"But I don't think so. The trackers have examined the sign, and this is their reconstruction. After the crash 12 days ago, 4 people left the site, 2 of them women, and 1 of the men with an unbalanced gait. Then, within the last 36 hours, 2 men returned to the wreck. They are certain it was the same 2. The boot prints match, and 1 of them has the same favour to his left leg."
Bukharin nodded.
"On the second visit, the wreck was stripped of much loose equipment. The 2 men left the area carrying heavy packs and joined the footpath that crossed the head of the valley about 6 miles from here. There the tracks have been confused and covered by other traffic."
"I see." Bukharin was watching him.
"Now tell me your other conclusions."
"There are 2 black and 2 white persons. With my own eyes, I saw them at Tuti airstrip. The 1 black is undoubtedly Minister Tungata Zebiwe. I recognize him."
"Wishful thinking. He is your 1 last hope of making good our bargain."
"I would know that man anywhere."
"Even from an aircraft?"
"Even then."
"Go on,"
Bukharin invited. The other black person I did not recognize, nor did I get a good enough view to positively identify either of the whites. But the pilot is almost certainly an American woman named Jay. Although the aircraft belongs to the World Wildlife Trust, she has the use of it. The other white is probably her lover, a British writer of sensational fiction who has an artificial leg, accounting for the unbalanced tracks. These three are unimportant and expendable.
The only one of importance is Zebiwe, and now we know that he is still alive.
We also know that he has eluded you, my dear General, Bukharin pointed out. I do not think he will continue to do so much longer.
Peter Fungabera turned to the sergeant, who was standing attentively behind him.
You have done well, very well, so far. Mambo. I believe that this Matabili dog and his white friends are being hidden and fed by the local people. Mambo. We will question them. Mambo. We will start with the nearest village. Which is it? The village of Wuzomanzi lies beyond this valley and the next. You will move in and surround it. Nobody must leave or escape. Not a goat, not a child. Mambo. When you have secured the village, I will come to supervise the interrogation.